Hello, welcome back. Today I speak to my Guardian colleague Freddie McConnell, the dad who gave birth and made a documentary about it that is out in cinemas this week. And marking the 80th anniversary of the start of World War II. Freddie McConnell is a Guardian journalist and a transgender man.
I think when I was a child, I understood myself to be a boy. And then it got a bit more complicated during puberty. And now, you know, I understand myself to be a man. And I understand myself to be a man who can be pregnant and give birth. And I'm really, I feel that's a gift.
In 2016, he began to think about having a family.
Yeah, I've always known that I would want to have children one day.
And decided to make a film about the experience.
This is a film about me having a baby. But what I feel like I'm going through isn't me having a baby or pregnancy. It's like a much more fundamental sort of total loss of myself.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the story of a man who gave birth. In 2013, Freddie began the process of medical transitioning. During this time, the issue of his fertility and the question of egg freezing came up.
Before I started testosterone therapy, I remember being asked to sign a consent form, I suppose. And within that consent form was a line about fertility, and I was advised to look into gamete freezing, ask my GP about it, with the caveat at the time that it was almost certainly not going to be funded by the NHS and would be very expensive and had a very low chance of success anyway. So it was a bit of a box-ticking exercise, it felt like. And I was in my early 20s and really desperate to get on with my life, which for me meant transitioning.
And what did transitioning mean? So testosterone therapy,
yeah.
Essentially?
Yeah, in the first instance, yeah. And then I later went on to have top surgery, but I definitely said to myself at the time, I mean, I'll just deal with this at some point in the future. And I thought about adoption and a surrogacy, and I understood that I would be infertile. So,
did you? Is that what you believe, that the testosterone would do to you, make it very difficult or impossible?
Yeah,
pregnant.
That was what I was told. But things have changed so quickly in terms of the care that trans people now can access. It's more the case that there's this assumption that when you start testosterone, if you're a trans man, you'll be on it for life and you'll never think about going off it for any reason whatsoever. The reality is way more complicated than that. You may go off it for other medical reasons which aren't related to transition. You may go off it in another country, for instance, if you don't have health insurance or access to it. And as I learned, some people go off temporarily in order to conceive and start a family. And no one ever told me that within the NHS.
Do you remember what the doctor told you in terms of not being able biologically to have a child if you went ahead with the testosterone therapy?
The message was very clearly that this is the end of your ability to have biological children. So if you haven't frozen your eggs at this point, that's it.
How did you find out that as a trans man,
yeah,
you could become pregnant?
Well, I think before that, I must have known about, you know, Thomas Beattie, who I think was the first trans man to really, his story to go like global in terms of carrying his own children.
Now that we know that the pregnancy is healthy, these are tears of joy. And we see her as our little miracle.
I mean, it's important to understand that could is a complicated word in this context, right? Because it wasn't just the physical ability, it was almost being allowed to.
Being allowed to, according to who? I mean, who did you think had
society,
to give you permission?
My doctors, you know, because, again, in this country, the way that you access care as a trans person can feel very paternalistic, and it comes with certain conditions. You're allowed to do this, but only if you sort of play by these rules. And before, that would mean adhering to certain gender stereotypes about being like a quote, you know, regular bloke or a respectable lady or whatever it is. That's fallen away to some extent, but certainly the idea of being pregnant as a trans man when I transitioned, which was around the turn of the noughties into the 2010s. So because sometime later when I did go back to the same consultant, like years later, and say, actually, this is what I'm thinking of doing, his mouth fell open and he just said, well, I've never heard of that happening, or words to that effect.
What, an expert in people transitioning had never heard of that happening?
Mm. Yeah, or like, you know, that's not something I've ever encountered, that sort of thing. So
tell me about the process you went through when you realised, okay, so, first of all, that people had done it, secondly, that you were going to do it.
I maybe would have been suggested a video on YouTube.
I made an emergency appointment at the doctor, thinking, okay, well, I'm pretty much pregnant. The looks on the nurses and the doctor's faces when I told them what I was in there for was just hilarious, to say the least.
Where someone in the States was documenting his pregnancy. I certainly did see that, and I just think that was probably the first real life example of someone where I kind of followed his progress quite closely and let myself really explore the idea. And I probably at some point, maybe after 2 years on testosterone, I sort of became more comfortable with the idea of maybe trying to do it myself one day, but I still was looking for some kind of permission from someone else in the community that I knew and could sort of speak to about my fears and doubts, but also you know, the sense that I wouldn't just be rejected by my friends and family or society, and I wouldn't be crossing the kind of ultimate taboo.
You said you were kind of searching for someone to give you permission. Was there something that happened which made you feel like you had permission?
There was a sharp curve in terms of sort of trans visibility, right? And I think everyone has felt that, and other trans people included have felt like suddenly that we have access to much bigger communities online and lots more resources. So I had realized by that point that it was possible for me to pause testosterone therapy and to regain my fertility and to have a perfectly safe and healthy pregnancy. But I still believed at that point that probably testosterone would harm my fertility over time. I now know that there is also no evidence for that per se, because no one has studied it. And actually, I've come across trans men in online groups who have been on testosterone for 10, 15 years, who have come off and had wonderfully healthy, happy pregnancies. So if anyone out there wants to do some research on this, that'd be great, because I just hate the idea that people are missing out on the ability to have a family in this way if that's what they want. Obviously, we're a small group of people, but anyone that loses that choice and that ability is, it's not fair.
Am I imagining that?
Oh, no, wait.
That looks like a positive result to me, darling.
Why did you decide to document the process? Do you hope that by documenting it, you'll be reassuring other people in the future in the same way?
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's not the same as a sort of leaflet that you might pick up at your GP's office, but it will hopefully just sort of do that thing of showing someone like me or a non-binary person who's thinking about carrying their own baby, yes, this is totally something that you can consider, and, you know, don't think it's not for you. Yes, on one level is a story about a trans man having a baby, but on several other levels is a much more universal film and story about love and family.
You were quite young, yeah? At the point at which you're considering going ahead and having a baby by yourself, you're in your late 20s. And I mean, I know lots of people who've had babies by themselves, and largely they've done it more like in their late 30s when they realise that their hopes to end up in a relationship aren't really happening for them within the time frame.
I decided that I needed to start a family when I did, because I thought that testosterone would be damaging my fertility and that there would come a point where it would make me infertile, even if it hadn't done up until now. So that is really what set the timing. And I was a bit naive, I was a bit gung-ho, but I also knew that I had my family around me and I live in a small town, and so the idea of being a single parent never really terrified me. And I think there's some ways in which being a single parent is incredibly hard. I know that. But there is also some ways in which it's a gift because you don't have another adult to, you know, bicker with the whole time and stuff.
That's one way of looking at it. What were your fears for the process?
That coming off testosterone would be really hard.
How does testosterone make you feel?
It makes me feel normal, feeling like myself, feeling kind of on an even keel and strong and resilient and all these things. Not strong physically, but just, you know, being in a good place. The thing I've been really surprised by is how every trans man I've ever met talks about testosterone in a really different way, and some people don't like it and aren't even on it.
What was it like going off testosterone?
You stop taking testosterone and then you wait. Will you get your cycle back? When will it happen? I've spoken to people who didn't get their cycle back for a year or 6 months or 2 years. Like, literally, you know, it's so down to the individual and their physiology. I only had to wait about 6 months.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Freddie. How's it going?
All right. I feel like I want to say this in like the manliest voice I can muster. We have a period.
What did that feel like?
I mean, you know, is there any more of a mixed bag of emotions? Because, you know, on the one hand, you're relieved because the plan is working. And that's very much what I felt like I was doing. I had a plan and I knew that it was going to be hard, but I was prepared. Part of this whole picture is because we're not given full information about fertility and family planning and contraception, for instance, because there's also a sort of assumption that trans people don't even have sex at this point. A lot of trans men are under the impression that testosterone is an effective contraceptive, and it is not. So trans men do sometimes get pregnant unexpectedly while on testosterone and then either miscarry or have to have an abortion. There have been unplanned pregnancies where trans man has fallen pregnant and immediately stops his testosterone therapy, and that leads to a healthy birth. I mean, and also there's an incredibly tragic case in the States of a man going to the emergency room complaining of abdominal pain, and doctors wouldn't believe that he could be pregnant, and he told them he'd had taken a pregnancy test that morning. Because they didn't do the checks they would usually do for a woman,
You all right?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't expect that to hit me. Then it later turned out that his baby died. And oh, God. Sorry. If they'd have understood that trans men could be pregnant, as soon as he'd arrived and done the checks that they should have done, they might have been able to save the baby. And as it was, he delivered a stillborn baby. And, you know, so when we talk about access to fertility care and family planning, things like that, it's not because we are being unreasonable or it's not PC gone mad. It's because stuff like that happens.
What did you know about pregnancy before you got pregnant?
My brother was born when I was 11, so I saw my mum being pregnant, and my mum's always talked about pregnancy in very positive terms.
I love being pregnant. Yeah, everyone should experience it, shouldn't they? I think. Especially men.
My sister too, but really probably knew about as much as any other man knows about pregnancy.
I mean, you expected it to be emotionally and physically challenging, but yeah. Watching the film, it was also psychologically challenging in ways you hadn't quite anticipated. I mean, what was your experience of pregnancy like?
As I was going through it, I was talking to people online and becoming friends with some people going through the same thing in the States and in the UK. And I got this sense of actually probably struggling the hardest out of this small group of people that I was communicating with. That may have been partly to do with not having a partner.
I love the moment in the film where you joke, if more men went through pregnancy, the whole experience would be handled differently.
I did not expect to feel this uncomfortable, and I think if all men got pregnant, then, like, my God, pregnancy would be taken so much more seriously and talked about. And I would have known what to expect because it would be this thing that men have to suffer through.
I was really shocked by how much of it clearly is something that a lot of women go through when they're pregnant, but still isn't talked about. You know, like literally just as basic as morning sickness not being morning sickness. Like I experience nausea all day, every day.
Me too. Yeah. I found pregnancy extremely difficult, but obviously mm-hmm. you're so lucky to be pregnant. It's not the sort
exactly.
of thing you
yeah.
moan about.
Well, it was, but it, yeah.
I used to vomit under the table and then come up and go on air on TV.
Wow. Well, I was never actually sick. So like, I always thought, I felt a bit jealous of the people that could be sick because I thought that might like shift the nausea, whereas I was just...
It didn't.
Okay. and you know, the physical discomfort and I didn't sleep. I sleep on my back usually, and you're told not to sleep on your back. But, you know, you're not really sure why. And everything you read tells you something slightly different.
I mean, in addition to the influx of all the pregnancy-related hormones, you're also coping with the absence of testosterone.
Yes.
I should really be going to sleep, but I just feel like my defences are so depleted. That question of whether it would be easier to have just been born not trans.
What was the combination of those things like?
What felt hard was the dysphoria, which really felt exactly the same as it had felt before I'd been on testosterone, but like much worse. Dysphoria is very, very hard to describe. Well, the best analogy I've ever heard is of, and I don't know who to attribute this to, it's like it's a cosmic toothache.
It's like a kind of profound sense of unease.
Physical discomfort, I find.
And you say that you don't want to talk about what you were going through as being more difficult than other people, but having a bump as a man is something that society isn't used to.
Well, unless your bump looks like a beer belly.
That's true. Did yours? That's true, actually. Well, I see men who look pregnant all the time.
Exactly. You will now see it everywhere. I remember my mum texting me saying, there's a man on the platform at the train station standing right next to me, and he could definitely be pregnant.
Did it make you feel self-conscious?
The dysphoria, it makes me feel self-conscious in a way that's completely disproportionate to reality. But the bump wasn't really the problem. I loved the feeling of movement and kicks and that kind of thing, because again it grounded me, it gave me this, it reminded me what I was doing and why I was doing it, and refocused my mind. People read gender incredibly fast and they will default to male, so I had, you know, facial hair and I had a deep voice, and no, I carried really small, so I just felt quite confident that I was just gonna be read as a pot-bellied man. Like
you did say in the film, I think, that you felt like an alien.
Yeah, internally, but like that was the struggle, that was what was hard. Not I was never once read, as far as I know, as a pregnant man, like by strangers or in public. It's just not something that's going to occur to people.
And at one point you expressed frustration at the well-intentioned women who tried to tell you that their experience of pregnancy was similarly difficult. What was it that you found annoying or unwelcome about those sort of comments?
Well, it wasn't the kind of people trying to directly compare. People were generally a bit more sensitive than that. It was just, it really reminded me that I didn't have anyone that I could talk to and relate to other than the people I was in touch with online.
What he's doing is such a brave and amazing thing to do. It's much braver than we can imagine. You know, I'm in awe of him, basically.
Tell me about the birth. That is an incredibly intimate experience. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I would say, embarrassing experience, perhaps. What made you decide that you could allow that to be part of the film?
I thought about whether and how to document the process. I realised that the story needs the birth. In a, it sounds quite clinical, but
in a filmmaker like, kind of way,
exactly. You know, I make video. My day job is making videos, and
when you're trying to persuade your subjects to do things, and when you are the subject, you're like, oh yeah, We're going to need the cameras in for that.
Yeah, but I was hardly aware of the camera being there.
That's it.
My son was born in the call, so I caught him in the water and had to sort of hold him still for a while he was released from the sack, and then brought him up. And, you know, as someone who's like, has got a naval family history and grown up by the sea and feels very connected to that kind of stuff, and being a seahorse dad, it all just is, you know, perfect.
And how's it been being a parent?
It's great. Well, it is great, and it's really hard. And so many cliches are true that it's really boring, and it's also really fascinating.
At one point in the documentary, we see you explaining to, I would say, a well-meaning family friend that you were a father and not a mother. Were those kind of conversations frustrating?
I think people find it can find it really challenging, that idea of, you know, yeah, I'm my son's father, I'm my son's dad. But that isn't to say that you have to immediately understand all the nuances and the complexities of that, or that I'm not fully aware that I'm a different kind of dad.
There were things in the film that people said that sometimes offended you. I guess some people don't have the vocabulary to discuss some of the issues. Do you sympathise with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you think we change that?
Yeah, just listen to us. Like, believe us, trust us. All this really simple stuff that sounds so banal, but we're just still consistently failing to do it.
Freddie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anushka.
That was Freddie McConnell. Do go and see his brilliant film, Seahorse, The Dad Who Gave Birth, which was directed by Jeannie Finlay. It's in UK cinemas this week and will be on BBC Two later this month. Fred has also recently been in the news because of a legal challenge he launched to try to win the right to be named as his child's father on the birth certificate. In the case, his identity had been protected by an anonymity order, but a judge recently lifted that after a challenge by another media organisation. The ruling is imminent, and Freddie will be able to talk about the case after it arrives. Coming up, why the lessons of World War II are more important than ever. Now, yesterday marked 80 years since the start of World War II. The Observer's Andrew Rawnsley asks whether the peace and prosperity that emerged after 1945 is now at risk.
Six years of the most intensely murderous and geographically spread conflict in the history of the human species had left unprecedented devastation. Yet from the ashes of this terrible legacy was born a new world, some of which at least would come to enjoy prosperity and peace of a kind not seen before. Now, at the forefront of the creation of this new world was the United States, which had been left as the world's greatest industrial power. And yet, rather than rest on this superiority, its post-war leadership was determined to try to learn from the follies which had led to 1939. While President Harry Truman and his key lieutenants saw their duty as to being to uphold the interests of America, they conceived those interests in sufficiently expansive and enlightened terms to reconstruct Europe. And this was accompanied by a determination among a new generation of European politicians that their continent should never again be the crucible for conflict. The First Congress of Europe met in The Hague in May 1948, and from that meeting evolved, ultimately, a European Union of 28 members, which will become the most prosperous trading area and, for all its faults, the most successful example of soft power in the history of the world. Britain's experience of World War II was unique, and it explains a lot about post-war British history, right up to our current convulsions over Brexit. Britain was neither an aggressor nor one of the conquered. Unlike Germany, Britain felt no war guilt, Unlike Stalin's Soviet Union, it had not started out on the wrong side, and it had not arrived to World War II late, like the United States. Post-war Britons wrapped themselves in a national legend about standing triumphantly alone, and I think, at least with some people, you can still hear echoes of that time and that feeling in the current Brexit debate. Having given you an account of what I think was this very creative and enlightened period of statecraft since 1945, one has to admit now those assumptions and structures look much more contingent. The EU has got a lot of internal tensions and it's about to lose a member. Donald Trump is absolutely unprecedented. No previous occupant of the White House has challenged so many of the fundamental tenets of the post-war order and placed so many Western alliances under such stress, and often suggested that he actually has more admiration for various authoritarian regimes around the world more than he does for his fellow Democrats in the Western world. There are many people now I know who are feeling quite gloomy about the world, some even seeing parallels between what's happening in the second decade of the 21st century and what happened in the 1930s. I take a slightly different lesson. It's not to say that human rights, liberal democracy, freedom of expression, open societies, international cooperation, I don't think that's all doomed, but it reminds us they need constant advocacy, effort, and guardianship. The key insight of those enlightened architects of the post-1945 world was that you don't get peace, freedom, and prosperity automatically. They can't be taken for granted. They have to be worked for. Better worlds can happen, but they only happen with imagination and effort.
That's all for today. My thanks to Freddie McConnell and to Andrew Rawnsley. Do read the coverage of the World War II anniversary that was included in a special supplement of The Observer at theguardian.com. Today's programme was produced by Mithali Rao, Rachel Humphreys and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Tomorrow we'll be trying to make sense of the battle between the government and Parliament over Brexit.